Welcome to Overtime with the Sports Docs. On each of these mini episodes, Catherine and I chat about a new topic or a new surgical technique in the field of sports medicine. We'll give you our quick take on the indications, various surgical approaches, and overview of the outcomes. We're really excited to bring this new style to our listeners, and we would love to hear your feedback about it.
On today's Overtime episode, we're going to chat about extra-articular augmentation of ACL reconstruction, specifically focusing on lateral extra-articular tenodesis, or LET. The need for this procedure arose due to the concern that even our best anatomic ACL reconstructions often fail to restore rotational control, resulting in a persistently positive pivot shift test, which has been strongly associated with worse clinical outcomes, increased functional instability, and possibly even arthritic changes.
So LET is not new. It was actually originally used nearly half a century ago prior to us having intra-articular ACL reconstruction techniques. It essentially, in most cases, utilizes a strip of the IT band shuttled in some way around and docked proximal and slightly posterior to the FCL origin at the lateral epicondyle. The benefit really is twofold. First, it controls anterolateral rotational control due to the longer lever arm than the intra-articular graft itself. And then the second thought is that it decreases stress on the ACL graft, oftentimes by 40 or 50%. And the thought is by offloading the graft, it may lessen risk of graft failure.
So surgeons have been using LET procedures for a long time now to address rotational laxity and to gain more control in the setting of ACL tears. So the indications that everyone knows are in the revision setting, but Ashley, I'm just curious, what other sort of thoughts do you have about indications?
So definitely in the setting of having a high grade, grade three pivot shift test, in the absence of having other injuries to the collateral ligaments and making sure we rule out a posterior lateral corner injury. So that's definitely one. And also definitely patients with hypermobility, hyperlaxity of certain body parts, especially hyperlaxity of the knee, where I'm concerned about there being some of that anterolateral laxity that's going to increase the force on the ACL graft and predispose to more failure. So definitely in those patients as well. Any other ones that you consider, Catherine?
Well, I think that hyperlaxity piece is really important. So I'm always surprised when someone doesn't have a history that's super obvious or, you know, coming to you with a diagnosis associated with hyperlaxity syndromes. But then you sort of just say, hey, do you hyperextend your elbows or do you hyperextend your knees? And then you start to realize that it's all throughout. That always sort of surprises me and makes me remember how important it is to access that routinely.
Definitely. And that's really important. There was a paper, I forget which podcast episode we were talking about it, but risk of ACL graft failure by LaPrade and his team talking about how hypermobility was an independent risk factor for ACL failure. So, you know, we do know that increased mobility of the knee is going to put more strain on the ACL graft and lead to that failure. There's some people that are talking about doing it for chronic ACL tears. Do you consider that? Is there some finding that you would consider doing in an LET just because it was chronic?
So I think, you know, you brought up two things. So one, LaPrade, and I think how he teaches, as well as that chronic nature. So when I was with him in fellowship, you know, routinely when you're doing the chronic ACL workup, there was, you know, not only looking at things in clinic, like your long leg standing, making sure there's not misalignment, things like that. But then also that was really emphasized when you're in the OR and you know you're going in for a revision ACL, your intraoperative examination under anesthesia was so important because that's really like the best way to assess your rotational instability and just looking at how significant is that pivot shift under exam.
Definitely, absolutely. And you would think that some of these chronics have, you know, perhaps meniscal deficiency. I don't think just having meniscal deficiency is going to lead me to do an LET, but a profound meniscus deficiency with that high-grade pivot, definitely you're worried about already having a loss of those secondary stabilizers like your medial meniscus, and you worry about the increased strain on the graft. So definitely that exam, as you said, is of vital importance.
Yeah, and I think, you know, there's others who will do it in the primary setting. I certainly am not doing that at this point, but, you know, I think the reasons or indications they're giving are more about, how rotational is their sport at baseline? You know, are these high risk individuals because maybe they already have some failure risk attributes, whether they're, you know, just gender or age based. But I do know that some people are doing them in these high level sort of rotational athletes, but that's not something that I've integrated into my practice.
And also they talk about too, one of the papers by LaPrade talked about having a posterior tibial slope, you know, greater than 12 degrees as an indication. And it makes you think, because a lot of times we'll get these alignment films and maybe people are right on the borderline and, you know, talking to them about doing an HTO or some sort of osteotomy and setting back their recovery. And a lot of athletes, they don't want that. And so you wonder, maybe these people that are on the cusp, maybe thinking about doing something for them. So these indications are evolving. And as you said, there are people doing them for primary ACLs across the board. I'm also not there yet. I think it is it's a major procedure. It's a surgical incision there, increased pain there, not without its risks of overconstraint or things like that. So I think I'm approaching it similarly to how you are.
Yeah, no, I think criteria is still evolving. So, but we both work, I think, with a higher risk group, you know, with just a majority kind of female population. So I think probably something for us to always be watching.
Absolutely. And so we talked a bit about the graft and we talked about IT band. Are you always using IT band? Any other like local graft choices or free grafts that you use?
So far, I'm always using ITB. I know, you know, we could integrate hamstrings. That's really the only ones that I've ever used in my training. Although I just find that the iliotibial is just the easiest to access. You're going to have the reduced morbidity and then you're not introducing cadaver.
Absolutely. I completely agree. I'm primarily using ITV as well. And you know, it's fixated distally at Gerties and you're just kind of, so I completely agree.
So once you prepare your ITV graft, do you pass it under the FCL or the LCL? I know that speaks volumes about studying under LaPrade when you say FCL, but LCL, do you pass it under the LCL?
So yes, I do pass it under the LCL or the FCL. I know that there's some concerns, or I was reading some more concerns about devascularizing the LCL. You know, I just use a blunt Kelly, go underneath, really stay, you know, extra articular, stay, make sure that I'm not damaging the popliteus tendon, and just shuttle it under. I think that that route just leads to really great lateral stability. But I agree with you there. Looking, if you search LET, the number of surgical techniques that are out there is profound for such a procedure that recently has been kind of adopted back into ACL reconstruction techniques. There, I lost count. I gave up on learning them all. So and there's a bunch of different routes you can take through the tibia all around. I just go under the LCL and just dunk it posterior and slightly proximal to the LCL attachment site.
Yeah, same. We've spoken in the past before about twisting, that we've both read in the literature that you can twist about 180 degrees. That's not something that I've ever really seen anything clinically based, more, you know, just sort of outside the lab, as far as I haven't seen any clinical outcomes that says that's really going to change, you know, their continuation of rotational instability.
Yeah, I agree with you. And it's interesting in most of my learning and then also reading about it, not many people are twisting it, but I did see that reported. I mean, I guess it's like externally rotating the ACL graft, right? If it makes people feel good, then we can do it. But I don't know how much it's really going to change clinically. So once you pass it under, how do you fixate your ITB graft?
So I think I was trained in two different ways to get fixation. Both, I think, are really reasonable. One requires a little bit more effort with technique. But I think the most simplest way is using a Richard staple. And that's pretty, you know, easy, straightforward. You're not as worried about dealing with ACL femoral tunnel. But I think I'm very quick to use fluoroscopy in the OR. So if it's a multi-leg or an LET or an ACL, and I just want to make sure that my tunnel locations are okay, and that I'm not going to have any interruption or disruption of a tunnel, I'm very quick to use a C-arm. So if that's if I'm using some sort of anchor.
Yeah, I agree. I use either an anchor and try to do like a suture staple technique with one of those knotless anchors or the metallic staple. I really love avoiding metal, especially in young individuals and especially in my female, you know, population that doesn't have maybe a lot of subcutaneous tissue along the IT band there laterally. So I really like to avoid a staple, but oftentimes, I mean, you're right there by the ACL tunnel. I worry about the amount you have to drill to then get that anchor in, even though you're setting it. So I do think a staple is, as you said, very reliable. I know some people are using the interference screws like you had mentioned, and I think there was some talk about even doing like a tightrope or something to secure it down, but I'm definitely using primarily the staple at this point.
Yeah, and I think kind of echo what you said about metal. I think the other reason why I try and avoid the metal is just, you know, you just never know what's going to happen to this individual down the line, whether they're transitioning to, you know, a total knee sometime, or, you know, they have another trauma and they need a revision. You know, metal just always complicates things and your access points. And if you have to remove it, you know, adds time and morbidity and all those things. You know, you just have to think about what could happen in the future.
Absolutely. I completely agree. Biocomposite screws all the way unless they break and then they get metal. So absolutely. And then,
Go ahead. What were you going to say?
No, your turn.
So what about tensioning and the position of the knee? So when you are doing your fixation for the LAT, what are you doing at the knee?
So very important to keep it in neutral rotation, so not internal or external for me. The literature that I had read kind of ranged, some people saying 60, most people saying 30. So I do 30 degrees neutral rotation and fixate it with really minimal tension. I think we're so geared towards, like, when you're tensioning your ACL, like, I am pulling the absolute heck out of that thing. I'm pulling as hard as I can. It's cutting into my fingers. I'm like, as hard as I possibly can when I'm fixating that. And this, like, you start to do that and you realize you really can't. You don't want to overconstrain laterally. So I'm just applying some tension, neutral rotation, 30 degrees, and fixating it, letting the staple do the work. What about you?
Yeah, same. I would say my window is like 20 to 30 degrees. I'm always staying on that lower end of the side, just pulling tension proximally. Same. Neutral is the most important, I think.
Awesome. Nice. And then what about post-op? So if you're just doing an ACL plus an LAT, so not like a multi-leg or things like that, what's your post-op protocol? Does it change compared to a standard ACL?
So post-op, I'm pretty much doing the same thing. I really don't change my routine or my protocol post-op. For those, you know, that I might be worried, they might get a little stiff. I think it's more of a conversation that I have with them. Just, hey, this is something that we're going to be watching you closely for, so that if we have to be a little bit aggressive down the line, we will. But I don't change the details of the protocol in any way.
Yeah, I agree. Same. I think, you know, we were chatting a little earlier about this, that I sometimes am guarded with my very early flexion with ACLs. You know, I just don't want to go to like 140, 150 immediately post-op and potentially stretch the graft. Not that most of them do. So I tend to limit them to 90 for the first couple of weeks, but I agree with you, the concern for stiffness. So maybe that would be the only change, but otherwise I completely agree. You just want to get them moving and weight bearing is tolerated. Really no need to limit their weight bearing in the absence of any meniscus repairs. So I agree.
Yeah, same.
Nice. We're in agreement. Thank you for listening to our Overtime Chat. We hope you enjoyed our conversation. Make sure to subscribe on iTunes, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts to stay up to date on all things sports medicine. If you like what you hear, please consider leaving us a review. You can also reach us by email at thesportsdocspod@gmail.com or find us on Instagram at thesportsdocspod. We love your feedback.